good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to the second episode of Dark Reading Radio at Black Hat 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, your host for these episodes, and today we have another wonderful episode as Kelly Jackson Higgins, Dark Reading's executive editor, and Sarah Peters, senior editor at Dark Reading, each sit down with a participant in the Black Hat Conference to talk about special issues in security today. Because it's a great episode, I don't want to take too much time, so let's begin with Kelly Jackson Higgins, who got on the phone with Wesley McGrew to talk about secure penetration testing operations. Kelly, take it away.
Hi, welcome to Dark Reading Radio at Black Hat USA. This is Kelly Jackson Higgins. I'm the executive editor of Dark Reading, and I have with me today one of the speakers at Black Hat here, Wesley McGrew, who's director of cyber operations at Horn Cyber. Welcome to the show, Wesley.
Thank you.
So Wes is going to be talking about secure penetration testing operations. Specifically, the name of his talk here Wednesday is called Secure Penetration Testing Operations, Demonstrated Weaknesses in Learning Material and Tools. And Wes, I have to confess, the first time I read your abstract for your talk, I thought, wow, that sounds really counterintuitive. So pen testers not being security gurus. So why should pen testers, who are often elite security people, worry about the security of their pen tests?
Well, it's been my experience that penetration testers are rarely introspective about the security of their own tools and practices. So while we're very keen on finding vulnerabilities in client systems, their servers, their configurations, and the software that they use on their desktops, the security of the penetration testing tools and the operational security and the communication security of the practices that are used are very rarely looked at with much of an eye towards finding vulnerabilities in those practices. And it's been my experience that in looking at the security of those tools and practices, that there are many vulnerabilities in those practices that could lead to a compromise of the client or compromise of the penetration tester by a third-party attacker.
So I know this research you're going to talk about at Black Hat is sort of the culmination of two other phases you've looked at over the last few years. I know you've done talks at DEF CON previously. Tell us a little bit about sort of your previous research and then how it led into this phase that you'll be talking about at Black Hat.
Right. So the first year of this research focused specifically on attacker implantable devices. So things like the Pwn plug or Wi-Fi pineapple that can be hidden at a client installation during a physical penetration test and then later used as a backdoor for the penetration tester to compromise the network further. What I looked at in that research was what a third-party attacker could do to that kind of hardware if it were accessible to them. So one, in terms of forensic analysis of the device to determine what information had been stored by it, that also applies if a third-party attacker had implemented one of these devices and a systems administrator found it. But also the vulnerabilities that are present in the software of those devices. In that particular research, I demonstrated a flaw in one of those devices that would allow a third-party attacker that had the ability to craft network packets, the ability to remotely control that device and gain control over it and steal all of the data off of it. The next year of that research involved a survey of tools, and those tools were commonly used penetration testing tools available in Kali Linux that are used by most penetration testers on their engagements. I looked at the sort of communication security that those tools provide and the kinds of vulnerabilities that are found in those tools as well. So essentially, in their default configuration, most of those tools, you know, don't support strong crypto between the client and the penetration tester, leading the communications to be vulnerable if they're done over a hostile network, such as wireless or the public internet. So with those two looks at penetration testing operational security and communication security. This year's take on it then looks at why it's the case that that as a group, that as a profession, penetration testing is not adopted more secure practices. And it's what I put forward is that it's because of the learning materials and the tools that we use. And primarily in this research, I've looked at a broad set of learning materials and asked the question, do they teach insecure practices? Do they put forward the idea and the notion that there may be a third party monitoring the traffic or trying to intercept or modify that traffic? And so that's what I looked at this year.
Can you, Wesley, provide some examples of some of the security issues that you found with the tools, the materials?
Sure. So most of the materials that were analyzed did teach practices that if they're not done in a controlled environment, they're not done in an environment where you're certain to not have third-party influence, they leave this client vulnerable. So there are lots of instances of tools that give a penetration tester third-party command and control over a client's systems without that command and control channel being authenticated or encrypted in any way. And so these are things like reverse netcat shells, plain text FTP, unencrypted web shell backdoors, things like that that can be used to remotely control a compromised system. Well, if practices aren't in place to do that in an authenticated way and in an encrypted way, then a third-party attacker can intercept that traffic, view whatever sensitive client material is being exfiltrated over that channel, and even take control over that channel. So that's one thing. We've also seen the penetration testing learning materials advocate for the use of public proxy lists, Tor, online hash cracking services, and other types of things like that that bring in a third party, bring in a proxy operator, bring in the operator of a online hash cracking service. And the problem with that is you have no control then over who sees that traffic.
So what kind of, I guess I think this would probably be a pretty sophisticated attacker that would pull off something like this or try to pull off an attack during a pen test or targeting a pen tester. What type of attacker profile are we talking here that might take advantage of the situation?
So it would be a very attractive means of attack by a nation state or organized crime threat. The benefit of this for a threat like that is that if one compromises a penetration tester through vulnerabilities in that penetration tester's tools, they're able to follow that penetration tester along on all of their engagements, not just one. And so you get a lot of bang for your buck for that. You know, most secure organizations have penetration tests or contract out penetration tests on a regular basis. And so this serves as a good sort of smoke screen for malicious activity as well, because, you know, the traffic generated by the penetration testers is understood to be malicious in its nature by default. So by following that penetration tester around on that, it provides a good way to camouflage malicious traffic. Although in some cases with some of these tools, it really doesn't take a very sophisticated attacker to exploit them. It simply requires being in the right place on the network. And so if these tests were taking place over a wireless connection, over an open Wi-Fi connection during a wireless engagement, then you know, anybody within Wi-Fi range would have the capability of intercepting this. And across the public internet, then basically any hop along the trail between the penetration tester and the client would be able to take advantage of these types of attacks.
I'm wondering if, you know, if a company was attacked by, say, a nation state, and they found out about, you know, the breach, they went into their forensics and IR, would they be able to tell if any of it came from the pen test or a pen tester? Is that something you could actually trace?
It might be difficult to. It would be difficult to determine that it was originally from the penetration tester's activities. On our own tests, we have identified instances where on a penetration test, we have found back doors that have been left by previous penetration testers. And so that's a definite, you know, a vulnerability or breach in the in what we understand a penetration tester to do, and what we understand as a profession for them to do is to leave a system open after the penetration test is concluded. So in that case, you know, we were able to identify, you know, a Metasploit interpreter shell listening on one of the client's hosts, and it turned out that that was a previous penetration tester. In a breach scenario, when information leaks out, it's often hard to find the origin of that, although this is definitely an attractive way of gaining that access in the first place.
Are there any sort of good tools or materials that you'd recommend to pen testers based on your research, like that you saw, where like, okay, this one's pretty good, or any recommendations you can give at this point? Or,
you know, right now, I think that any of the material is good to understand the mechanics of how penetration testing works, like literally how to use the tools. But it requires to actually put these practices into operational use against a real client on a real engagement. A tester needs to have some experience in testing their own tools and using what they know about network attacks and what they know about vulnerabilities and what they know about these networking protocols to examine their own tools and figure out which ones are not encrypting things and which ones they need to layer security around. And so it's not necessarily that the knowledge isn't out there to do it. It's just that there's not an awareness around doing it. And in the future, moving forward, learning material and tools need to address this as part of the training and part of the tool set.
Now, I know you're going to be releasing a proof concept tool at Black Hat. Tell us a little bit about what that is and the purpose of it and how it works.
Sure. To demonstrate some of these issues, I'm releasing a tool called Snagterpreter. And what it does is it allows an attacker to hijack HTTP and HTTPS interpreter sessions. So interpreter allows for remote command and control of a target system, a compromised system that you've attacked with Metasploit. With HTTP and HTTPS, it turns that into a stateless means of communicating with that client system. With the HTTPS version of this, the purpose of that in Meterpreter is simply to evade detection by intrusion detection systems. It is not intended to provide for actual communication security, because the Meterpreter listener that you have, the Meterpreter client and the Meterpreter listener that you have set up, do not validate the certificates. It's simply for obfuscation. So the communication security isn't there by default in Meterpreter. What Snag Interpreter allows you to do is to intercept those Meterpreter sessions if you're in a position to man in the middle of the connection or to view the traffic. It allows you to intercept those connections, gain control over that Meterpreter session, issue commands, and then turn it back to the penetration tester. So you could use it to set up a second Meterpreter session for yourself if you'd like to. This is not necessarily a vulnerability in Metasploit or Meterpreter. It's working as it was designed to work. And as a matter of fact, within the past year, they've added features to Meterpreter where if you follow the documentation and you go through the steps of creating certificates and enabling certificate pinning in Meterpreter, there's a what they call a paranoid mode where those certificates are checked and you wouldn't be able to intercept it in the same way, because that channel is actually providing communication security at that point.
And this will be something that you'll be releasing for free, and I assume it's probably geared mainly toward pen testers, right, or researchers who want to test.
That's right.
In their environments. Okay.
That's right. It's a proof of concept that penetration testers can play with, that researchers can play with, and use to show themselves and others that even, you know, your more sophisticated means of command and control, such as Meterpreter and HTTP and HTTPS Meterpreter sessions, if they're not careful with the use of them, that they can be intercepted.
So I guess my last question for you, Wesley, is sort of why are people not really talking about pen testing security and the security of pen testers until now? It seems like this is a pretty – I mean, I never thought about it until I started reading about what you were doing very closely. Why has it not been a topic of – a front-burner topic, do you think?
It's an excellent question. I mean, for starters, you know, security is a very reactionary thing. And so without there being a very high-profile breach involving a penetration tester, there's not as much attention placed to it. You know, we started looking very closely at third-party vendor interactions after the Target breach, and the HVAC vendor was the vector of attack on that. And so without one of those high-profile breaches that came in through a penetration tester, it's hard to call it a realistic attack vector. However, I would argue that, you know, a penetration tester will typically report on findings of vulnerabilities that would involve man-in-the-middle attacks, that would involve communication security, that would involve things like Telnet and plain text HTTP and the ability to hijack things like that. You know, we would throw a fit if Twitter or another social network didn't allow for HTTPS strong security, strong authentication login. We should be demanding the same things of our own tools. And as for why penetration testers haven't done that before, I think it's simply a lack of awareness. It's the mindset that they're in there to hack into or to break into their client systems by whatever means are necessary, by whatever means a real attacker would use. And there's not a mindfulness that they may not be the only attacker there. But we've seen on our tests that that's simply not the case. A lot of times we identify a third-party attacker on the systems at the same time as us. So I think it's a realistic threat. I think it just hasn't been taken seriously yet.
Well, I can only imagine, like, the first headline where a pen test was the source of a breach. That would be a huge story. I guess the hard part, too, like you were saying earlier, was that sometimes you really couldn't tell, right? There's some possible situations where it may have happened, and we just don't know for sure because it's probably hard to trace that back.
Yeah, in general, it's hard to attribute attacks. It's hard to determine the source of an attack sometimes. And, you know, with a on average, I believe it's been determined that it's a period of 6 to 9 months or something like that before somebody determines that they've been breached. Who knows if the forensic evidence is even still around by then?
Well, this has been really interesting, and I think your research is really important, and I think it's going to become a bigger, get a higher profile here now that you're releasing this tool and talking about it at Black Hat this week. So thank you so much. I appreciate your time today, and thanks for sharing your insights on it. And thank you to our audience today for joining us on Dark Reading Radio. And that's all.
Thank you.
That was Kelly Jackson Higgins talking with Wesley McGrew about secure penetration testing operations. We now turn our attention to an AI approach to security analysis as Sarah Peters talks with Konstantin Berlin. Sarah, it's over to you.
So your session is called An AI Approach to Malware Similarity Analysis, Mapping the Malware Genome with a Deep Neural Network. So why don't you go ahead, give us an overview of what that's all about.
So there are two specific, I guess, somewhat related but different problems that I'm trying to address. So one is, at Indensity, we developed this machine learning detector. So it's a detector that uses machine learning to figure out if a binary file is malware or benignware. And that's good, but a lot of times the user needs additional information. So, for example, they not only want to know if it's malware, they might want to know, well, what malware family is this coming from? Is this the root variant AA? And if so, then they can proceed maybe to look, go to Microsoft's website and look up what the root.aa means and what, you know, it's what it does, and then potentially develop some mitigation strategy for it. Hmm. So that's sort of an interesting problem. That's problem number one, and that's mostly what a typical user probably wants. But then there is a sort of a more complicated problem on top of that, and that's one of malware triage. And in malware triage, you don't necessarily, while you might want to know what family or variant it is, you are interested in exploring previously unseen samples, which might come from previously unknown families. So you're not interested in families, but you're interested in figuring out this file. Is this file, is this malware file similar to some previous malware that I have seen? And you have this huge database, for example, like large organizations like Mandiant, for example, they have huge databases of malware. And they go in and they find a new malware, and then they want to figure out, is this malware similar to some malware that they have in the database that they already looked at, that they might know something about, that they might attribute, for example, to some actor, you know, did it come from Russia, did it come to China? So that's an important problem. Might not necessarily be of interest to every user, but is of interest to big organizations, big enterprise networks. Make sense so far?
Definitely makes sense so far. Well, let me ask you this though. So you mentioned machine learning, but there's a lot of different definitions when I talk to people about machine learning. Some of them tell me one thing, some of them tell me something else. Some people talk about deep learning, which seems to mean something else. So what is your definition of it?
My definition of machine learning would be sort of this this automatic explanation of your observation without relying on a prior model. So let me explain. So, for example, if you're doing physics, right, and you're trying to figure out if, you know, the rocket is going to, you know, when you shoot the rocket, is it going to land in spot X, right? You have these complicated physics models that people have developed over, you know, centuries. And so that's one approach. But machine learning approach is more of a data-driven approach where you're not going to figure out how physics works because that problem might be too complicated. What you're going to do is you're going to observe the rocket fly, you know, you give input to the rocket, you know, you give input X and you observe rocket goes to Y, and then you give X 2 and then you observe Y 2. And you make millions of these observations. And because you have millions of observations, you just sort of automatically learn a rule that doesn't explain the physics. But it works. It works in terms of it does predict where the rocket goes. And so to me, machine learning is sort of this idea where the underlying phenomena is too complicated for a human to explain, or we just simply don't have the resources to put into an explanation of the phenomena, and you're solely interested in the prediction aspect of it versus understanding aspect.
Got it. Okay, so you don't necessarily need to know all of the rules. You don't necessarily need to know all the parameters and enter all of that in there. You just need a whole lot of data, and the system will sort out just enough of it to figure out what to give us the answers that we need to give us that predictive power. Am I understanding?
Right.
Things correct.
Yeah, yes, correct. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly right. You're solely interested in prediction, not explanation of. Like I said, there are two related problems that we were facing. So we developed this machine learning model that predicts if something is benign than malware. But the way traditional approaches work is they use signatures to identify benign malware. So they find, you know, some special set of bytes that represent a specific malware family. And then because they found these bytes in this file, they can not only detect if it's malware, they can at the same time say what kind of family it's coming from, right? Because it contains the special bytes related to this specific special signature for that family. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when you're using just prediction, right, you're saying benignware or malware, you no longer have that information. So the question is, can you reuse...
Oh, interesting.
Can you reuse the same technology that we developed for malware and benignware classification to do also family predictions, right? Can you get a really good family prediction using the same deep learning technology that we had with slight modification? And the reason why I'm suggesting you need these two separate tasks is because when you're doing machine learning, you want to train towards the task that you need. So if you want to be really good at classifying benignware versus malware, you shouldn't be doing this intermediate task of classifying families and then based on that trying to classify if it's benignware or malware, because you're just not going to get as good of an accuracy, right? And accuracy is paramount here. Right? First, we want to make the detection, and then if we can reliably say, we say what family it's from, because so a lot of malware might be new, might not even have family. So, you know, convoluting the two tests together doesn't make sense. So that's sort of the first problem is, now that we replace signatures, how do we get families out? And the second related task is this malware triage, as I mentioned, where large organizations might not necessarily even care what family it's from. What they care about is the relationship between files, whether this new malware that they found, piece of malware, is related to a previously seen piece of malware that might not have a family, and so they can do attribution, mitigation, things like that. So those are the two problems, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at sort of academic literature in terms of, you know, how well can you classify malware, so the first thing you'll notice is typically you're talking about, you know, classifying 20 most popular families. And while maybe that's good for, you know, an academic purpose, it's not really useful as a deployed system because there's a significant variety there's a large number of families and each family has a large number of variants, right? So even predicting a family name is not specific enough to be particularly useful to the client. So what you're focusing here on is, rather than that sort of more academic problem, you're focusing on a specific problem. Specifically, I'm talking about predicting 1,500 malware families and variants. And that's pretty much, if you look at, you know, how much Microsoft knows about, you know, families and variants, that covers more than 99% of active malware and their variants in the wild. So you're basically... more than reproducing the information that's provided by these traditional systems that use signatures for family prediction. And when we take that, so what we do here is that we take, you know, the original features that we developed that are really good at classifying malware versus benignware, and we re-engineer, re-architect our deep learning model to predict 1,500 classes. Instead of predicting one class, benignware versus malware, we're predicting now 1,500 classes. And when we did that, to our knowledge, we developed basically, as far as I know, the first deep learning family classifier, one that's, you know, I would say orders of magnitude, predicts more orders of magnitude more classes, and has extremely high accuracy. We're like around 97%. Accuracy. So, you know, you give it a file and it gives you a name and that's going to be, you know, 97% accurate, which is very high considering, you know, there is, when an organization assigns a label, like a family label to a piece of malware, you know, that has some issues with them too. So different organizations, one might say this is Veroot, other one might say it's like Sasser or something like that. So there is inconsistency in labels, so getting close to 97%, given that the labels are messy themselves, to our knowledge is sort of a state-of-the-art result. The other fact is, because you're using this deep learning model, the model itself is less than 15 megabytes, and so it can easily be deployed to an endpoint. So you take that 15 megabytes, you take, you know, 10 megabytes for a malware benignware detector, you have a 25 megabyte, you know, system on an end user that, you know, in under 10 milliseconds can immediately classify not only benignware but malware, but also the family type.
Wait, is it that small? It sounds to me like it's that's astonishing to me that you could do something like this and have it be that lightweight.
Yeah, and so the reason behind that is because machine learning is a more compact representation than signatures. So signature is sort of this all-or-nothing system where you say, like, does it have this feature? If yes, then it's definitely benignware or it's definitely malware. Machine learning doesn't work like that. It's a statistical approach, which doesn't make absolute decisions. What it says is, well, it has this feature and that feature and this feature and fifth and sixth and seventh, and it has this 20 features, and that's why it's malware. So it uses these weak indicators versus the strong indicators. And because it extracts these weak indicators, but a lot of them, like thousands of them from each individual file, and combines them together, it can be more accurate than a signature approach, but at the same time significantly more compact, because you're only looking at these weak indicators, and then you're proceeding to mix them using this deep learning model, which mixes them in this way, and it finds a way to properly mix them such that, you know, it gives the correct output, and that's sort of the training phase of the algorithm, which is also very scalable compared to all different machine learning approaches, because you can just feed them sort of few files at a time, and you can continue feeding them. And the more you feed them, the better your model gets, and you can run the, you know, and you can do this training for days, and, you know, you can buy more expensive hardware, and then you can run it for weeks, and then it sort of gets better the more you train it, which is a little bit different from some other system, which is you run it once, you train it, and that's it. There is no way sort of to improve the system. Here, it just isotonically gets better and better as you train, as you invest more resources into it, as you give it more samples, as you give it more training time, as you give it bigger hardware. But the model itself is incredibly compressive. Like I said, it's only 15 megabytes. And because it's so small, it's also very fast, right? Because smallness is related to speed.
That was Sarah Peters talking with Constantine Berlin about an AI approach to security analysis. Well, that's it for this episode of Dark Reading Radio from Black Hat 2016. We hope that you've enjoyed both episodes of Dark Reading Radio from Black Hat 2016 and will join us each month as the editors of Dark Reading bring you the latest in big stories from the world of IT security. And now for everyone at Dark Reading, I'm Kurt Franklin saying thanks so much for listening. Hey, stay safe out there.